Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lauffer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. As I say, every episode we have a great guest, and we do once again. Of course, I'm talking about Dr. Kyle Balzer, who is the Gene Kirkpatrick Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and he does a lot of work on great power, and he's one of the younger voices in the nuclear world. And so, of course, that's a great thing to have somebody who is also from my generation. And he's working on a book that you'll be excited about. He'll talk a little bit about that. But we had three great topics we wanted to talk about today. We'll talk about SLCM, the submarine launch cruise missile. Do we need it? Do we not? We'll talk a little bit about the origins of tailored deterrence, and it's a topic we haven't really talked about before. And then we'll also talk about hedging, the hedge. So if you remember, the Biden administration's nuclear posture review talks about eliminating the hedge. So we'll talk about, do we need one? Do we not need one? And so with that, Kyle, welcome to NucleCast.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Adam.
So Kyle, you're working on a book that we want to put the bug in everybody's ear. So when that book is out, they'll know to go pick up a copy. And what's the title of the book?
So it's currently a working title. It's based off my dissertation, but right now I'm working with the revivalist James Schlesinger and the rebirth or revival of America, Cold War U.S. deterrence strategy. He referred to himself as a revivalist, so that's where the revivalist comes from.
Okay, so that'll be a great topic. You know, Schlesinger doesn't get sometimes the coverage he deserves because he was a critical player. Now, let me throw open the big, broad question to you, and that is SLCM. Tell us about SLCM. Is it a capability the United States needs, and why?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think SLCM is, you know, the big missing piece now in our posture, given you know, we're no longer in the threat environment we were in 1991 when we removed SLCMs, TLAMs from the undersea and the surface fleet. We're no longer in that threat environment. And we're definitely not in the threat environment of 2009 when SLCM-N was retired. We have Russia, China we're trying to manage, and SLCM-N would be most important, I think, in the Asia Pacific as well as vis-a-vis Russia. But housing them on attack submarines in the Asia Pacific, it's primarily a maritime theater. I think there's four purposes that SLCM-N resolves for us for military capabilities all in one system, which is SLCM-N, which is that enduring regional presence in the Western Pacific. It's the promptness to respond for military effect within that theater. Third would be its widespread deployment on attack submarines, even surface vessels, which would increase survivability of our nuclear capability within the region, as well as it would complicate adversary defense planning as well in terms of air defenses, another trajectory of attack, that sort of thing. And also it assures us, I think, an ability to respond within the threat engagement envelope. So within China's and Russia's A2AD web, which I think is critical to extend deterrence, to bolster partner resolve, to keep our allies on side, and to basically extend deterrence to a region. Because right now we're relying in Europe on dual capable aircraft, which are vulnerable. And we don't have that same basing arrangement within the theater in the Western Pacific. We have to generate aircraft from the continent. and they'll be vulnerable as we're generating them. So Slicomen provides more survivability, penetrability, and all those things that I think we need to extend deterrence.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you that Slicomen is a good capability to have. For me, part of the challenge is when the administration talks about, you know, we have Ohio class submarines at sea in the Pacific, and then that sort of covers down for, let's say, Korea and Japan. I'm not going to lie, I don't really think a Trident D5 is a particularly good weapon unless you're talking about strategic nuclear war. If you want to talk about limited theater, small numbers, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to surface my Ohio class submarines to shoot one or two of their D5s at a target and then hope and pray that they can, you know, shoot and scoot, because they're, you know, they're highly vulnerable at that point. And, you know, the same could traditionally be said of a, you know, of attack subs with a Slicomen capability, because they have to do a similar maneuver to fire. But you also mentioned surface vessels, and this is where also I think we need to really look at Slicomen is adding it to surface vessels, because it creates a quite a bit different dynamic than, you know, just having those weapons on, you know, on submarines. And for me as a Navy guy, I was, you know, entering the fleet at about the time they were pulling nuclear cruise missiles off of surface vessels. And so I remember what that was like for the Navy at the time to have those missiles on. Have you seen much discussion of Slicomen anywhere other than on attack submarines? Because that's really where I see the discussion. Do you see it anywhere else, or is that just sort of more contemplation than sort of analytical discussion?
In the analytical discussion, I see it mostly on attack submarines. I think you're correct there. You're right. There's, you know, vulnerability issues with attack submarines, but they're still, relative to the surface fleet, much more survivable. So I think that's where you see the conversation focus on attack submarines. And that would be primarily where I would first house them, would be attack submarines for that survivability in theater presence. But yes, I think you're exactly right that housing them on the surface fleet, widespread deployment, that means, and that greatly complicates adversary planning. It provides another, you know, azimuth of attack, another trajectory that Russia, China have to worry about. They can't just focus on one system. They're focusing on this widespread deployment. So I think, you know, a surface fleet would greatly enhance deterrence of the Slicomen. But primarily, I think, you know, the conversation, to my understanding, rests on attack submarines at this point, because we're having a lot of trouble, obviously, building surface ships, right? And we have, you know, a lot of tubes we need to dedicate to the conventional side of things. So I think maybe the conversation is focused on attack submarines, because it's such a vital system to have that we at least need them, lowest common denominator, on attack submarines. We need to get that first. And then if, you know, it all depends on what happens with the budget, where they goes, what the Biden administration decides, what, you know, a potential Trump administration decides. So it all relies on the budget and what the budget can handle. And right now, there's a lot of things we need to do. So to my understanding, that's why it's focused on the attack submarines at this point.
Now, have you heard any, I'm a big fan of a return of Glick on the ground launch cruise missile and a Pershing 3. You know, if you spend much time in the archives at the Reagan Library, and as you know, I've spent a good bit of time working on a work on INF. And if you read those discussions and debates, the Russians, and I think you would see a similar case for the Chinese in particular, Pershing 2 scared the dickens out of them because of its capability and its closeness, and Glickum did as well. And if we talk about Slickum, and Slickum is actually a, you know, it's a really good capability, and it's really the nuclear leg that is coming in on time and under budget. And so with LRSO, and Slickum would ostensibly be a modified version of LRSO, is there any discussion about a Glickum variant, a ground launched variant? Have you heard that? It's not really something I've seen much of, but maybe you have.
I have not seen much discussion on it, and I think that is because due to the politics of it, basing within, you know, the island chain, whether that's South Korea, Japan would obviously be an issue politically. So I think that's where the trouble lies there. In Europe, I think right now we're trying to do a lot of things, especially with the Ukraine situation going on, that, you know, if you recall with those theater weapons in the late 70s, 1980s, it opened up just bogged down NATO in this political, you know, debate, caused a lot of problems there, especially when the Carter administration canceled the enhanced radiation weapon. So I think perhaps, to my mind, people are trying to avoid those political debates, and focusing on Slickum allows us to avoid that. But I think you're exactly right in, you know, the 1980s, bringing those theater weapons online. As you said, it scared the dickens out of the Soviet Union. The Soviets had a behavioral predisposition to plow enormous resources into air defenses. And so they were terrified of Glickums. And this was a cost-imposing strategy, which Schlesinger helped initiate this long-term kind of competition. And he, for a very good reason, he was the one who seeded money for the extended range Pershing 2, which was originally just the Pershing 2 was just going to be a shorter range follow on to the Pershing 1. But the idea was to extend the range, get the Soviets to spend more on air defenses as opposed to more threatening systems. And perhaps that's something that Slickum N could do today. China is much like the Soviet Union and Russia today, an authoritarian regime. Autocratic, they care most about the regime survival as opposed to anything else. So they're probably defensively minded in terms of air defenses. It probably drives them up the wall if we can get these capabilities like we did in the 80s. And I think that's, you know, a good point you make about, you know, Pershing 3, you know, lining the first island chain wherever we can with those. So I'm very sympathetic of the view. My main concern right now would be the politics of it. But I would be all in favor of, if the politics get sorted out, if the funding is there, just littering the island chain with these kind of shoot and scoot, you know, Glickums would be ideal if it's politically feasible.
Yeah. Now, the second topic we wanted to talk about, and it's one I'm particularly fond of, and this is the idea of tailored deterrence. And you know, many of our listeners probably remember this idea of general deterrence. I've got 25,000. You've got 25,000. We don't really have to know each other's language, understand each other's cultures. You know, if you shoot at me, I shoot at you, we all die. That was general deterrence, and it worked well. And then we come to tailored deterrence, and it's sort of evolved over the course of two or three decades. And for some folks, they remember Elaine Bunn's work when she was at NDU and sort of wrote a important text on tailored deterrence. But even before that, and this is something you're doing some work on, we said, well, we don't want to necessarily have just the PSYOP, and that's kind of our only option. So tell us about tailored deterrence, its origins, you know, why did we do it? What did it mean? Talk to us about that.
So when we think of tailored deterrence, I think it's generally thought of a post-Cold War 1990s. You know, there's an array of regional powers, and then there were the rogue states, Iraq, Iran, North Korea, that we needed to deter. And so we had several, you know, unique adversaries, unique culture, unique behavioral predispositions, all these sorts of things. So we needed to tailor deterrence to this array of regional threats we had. But really, I think, and I tried to make the case, that tailored deterrence dates back to the Cold War, with the rise of the Soviet, as you know, the RAND lexicon called it, how the Randites called it, the rise of the Soviet counter-deterrent in the late 60s, and then they blew past us. They gained quantitative superiority. How do we handle that? And so really, you know, this general deterrence, the PSYOP, these massive, you know, large-scale counterforce attacks due to the proliferation of Soviet silos, that was a non-starter now. So how do we, deter in an age of mutual assured destruction or mutual vulnerability? So the idea is to pare down the options to more selected and limited counterforce or counter-military targets. But what do you target? Because again, with the proliferation of silos, proliferation of hardened targets, what do we really need to target? How do we really get into the mind of the adversary in the age of, you know, mutual vulnerability? So the idea of Schlesinger and Andrew Marshall at RAND and others, it wasn't just them, the idea was we need to think a lot harder about deterrence. What do the Soviets value? Their regime, obviously, the Politburo's hold on the economy, their hold over society. What are those targets? And what do they care most about in terms of those targets? Schlesinger and Marshall had the sense from their work in the early 60s, along with Joseph Loftus, that they cared about air defenses. They valued those systems. They valued counterforce capabilities. They valued their own counterforce capabilities. So therefore, the thinking was they looked at us to what our counterforce capabilities were, because we're not trying to deter an abstraction. We're trying to deter real human beings who have perhaps a different perception or perspective than we do. Whereas McNamara and the systems analysts in the late 1960s didn't see much value in very advanced, sophisticated counterforce capabilities, Schlesinger and Marshall said, wait, hold up. The Soviets clearly value counterforce. They're building these heavy, massive missiles to kind of redress their limits in accuracy. So the idea was we need to get back into the counterforce business. We need to upgrade the Minuteman III. We need to enhance its guidance system. We need to bring online a heavier missile, what became known as the MX. Schlesinger urged this as early as 1965. Because we had our own accuracy deficiencies. So the thinking was a larger missile, larger payloads could offset our accuracy limits. And so we bring on a MX, Schlesinger programmed that. It was in progress, development, but he really started pushing that. And he was the one who pushed the new larger warhead for Minuteman III. And so he pushed the B-1. The B-1 was tailored deterrence for the Soviets' obsession with air defenses. Have a penetrating bomber, a terrain-hugging bomber with terrain-hugging avionics. This could get the Soviets, heighten their attention, what they cared about, to plow more resources into yet another round of costly defensive countermeasures in air defenses, which are obviously less threatening to us. We'd rather have them spend more on defense than offense. And so this kind of competitive strategy notion is where tailored deterrence really comes out of. And so I think it's important to realize this, because it was hard enough to tailor deterrence, get inside the mind of the adversary with one peer nuclear competitor. What happens when you have another peer nuclear competitor? They have their own perceptions about what systems they value most. And also we have these regional powers now. We have North Korea, Iran, who also are, Iran is pretty much a nuclear power now. They can get a nuclear warhead in days, weeks, months. So we have all these adversaries we need to tailor deterrence to. It was hard enough in the Cold War with one. So we need these hedges. We need these tailored capabilities. We need advanced counterforce systems, just like we did in the Cold War.
Yeah, and then you throw in to that mix, you know, now we have the ability to do significant damage via cyber or via space. So you throw in new domains, and then now the administration has created the concept of integrated deterrence, where we're going to have, you know, economic and diplomatic and informational. And so now deterrence has gotten just incredibly complex. And I often wonder, is it overly complex to be useful? Because if you make a message too complex for your adversary, he gets analysis paralysis and doesn't know how to make a decision. And your message can be muddled. So the more focused and sort of limited tailored deterrence, I think, was probably a bit more helpful.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right there. And I think what's overlooked, I thought the Strategic Posture Commission was great, but what was overlooked about it was a recommendation that hasn't gotten a lot of publicity, which was we need to start heavily investing in intelligence about how our adversaries think. And I think they made many great recommendations. And I think that was the single most important recommendation they made, is we need to know how China thinks about how Xi Jinping in particular thinks about deterrence. And we need to distill it down. Perhaps that can help us not getting bogged down in all the data, the integrated deterrence that you're mentioning. Just keep it simple and care about what our adversary cares about. So I think that's why we need to really invest heavily in, you know, the intelligence aspect of it, and getting that right. And then we can build out from there.
Now it's that time of the show where we have to take a quick break, and we will do that, and we'll be right back. This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. And we're back, and we're talking to Kyle Balzer, and Kyle, the third topic we wanted to talk about on this show is this concept of hedging, the idea that you have extra warheads, so that if you've got a problem with one warhead, perhaps one design, you have extras in the arsenal. Maybe you need to upload. And so like with Minuteman 3, you go from 1 to 3 warheads, which is the max for that delivery system. And of course, the nuclear posture review for the current administration said, hey, we want to get rid of the hedge. Now, so as you think about the hedge, what is it that you're thinking, and what's your take on it?
Well, with the hedge, as a trained historian, I'll draw from history. And in the late 50s, early 60s, we rolled out the lightweight Minutemen. We decided not to push hard with the Titan and Titan II, which were the heavier systems. Minuteman was lightweight, but we never got the accuracy down on the Minuteman 1 and 2, to really have that reliable weapon that could go after hardened targets. So we were stuck with the system that couldn't really carry out reliably our targeting options, the PSYOP. It couldn't do it discriminately. It couldn't do it reliably. So we had this issue here. We were stuck with this weapon system because we didn't hedge. You had people in the mid-60s talking about we need a large payload hedge, something that became the MX, and we didn't have it. So I think looking at that is reason enough why we were only deterring one adversary at the time. Now we're deterring several, as we talked about. And so there's going to be many surprises moving forward. We thought the Soviets would stop building. We didn't think they would harden as much as they would, their silos. And we were stuck with the Minuteman lightweight. Now it got better with Minuteman 3, but that was still less than we needed in the late 60s or early 70s when it came online. So now we have multiple adversaries who all think differently than we do. So we're going to be surprised here in the future. It's a very complicated threat environment. It's an unprecedented threat environment. So I think looking at our history with one peer adversary compared to the much more complicated threat environment today is just reason enough to hedge properly. Whether that is, I think we need to upload more warheads depending on where the Chinese strategic arsenal is going, depending on where its theater arsenal is going, depending on what Russia does, and so on, to North Korea and Iran. So I think hedging is just critical. You can't compete unless you have those long-term hedges that you're ready to bring online if you need them.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've sort of scratch my head frequently, and I'll often remind people, you know, during the Vietnam conflict, it took the U.S. 55,000 rounds of small arms fire to kill one adversary. So 54,999 rounds missed their target. And so this idea that if we've got, let's say, 1,000 targets, that all we need is 1,000 warheads because all 1,000 warheads will hit all 1,000 targets. That in and of itself is, I mean, it's ludicrous, but it just points to, hey, you need, sometimes you need extras, and that's called the hedge. And that's, you know, for a very good reason. And what people I sometimes don't give us credit for is as accuracy has gone up, yield has gone way down. And so if your yield is going down and you have to be more accurate, and then let's suppose we take a bolt out of the blue and we need extra, you know, warheads to strike targets, you got to have a hedge for that. So there's, you know, you mentioned a handful of reasons. There's lots of reasons that you really do need a hedge, and it's just a wise thing to do. Now, go ahead, Kyle.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
Well, what I wanted to do is I wanted to bring out Bob the Genie. And as I rub my magic lamp, of course, Bob pops out and Bob grants all guests 3 wishes. You can't wish for great wealth. You've already got a great beard. So, I mean, that's, I don't know what more you could possibly want, but no wealth, no world peace. But you can make 3 wishes related to the topics we've been discussing. So, Kyle, let me ask you. What is your first wish?
My first wish would be, and I presume it's going on, but heavy investment in how our adversaries think about deterrence. What do they see us doing that impresses them? What do they see us doing that doesn't impress them? And so I think the intelligence angle would be the first thing.
Okay, that's good. I mean, knowing how your adversaries think and what they value. We clearly know they've done that for us. I mean, Russian misinformation and disinformation is premised on the idea that they can shape our view because they know us. So it's a great first wish. Okay, so that's wish number one. How about wish number two?
Wish number two is continued, you know, bipartisan strong support for slick amend, because I think, you know, what I'm most worried about is that, you know, China's theater nuclear advantage, and also what I think doesn't get talked enough about is kind of the political purpose of China's build out. You know, the steady, you know, pressure, they're already engaged in a peacetime coercion campaign, and I think that's enabled by their strategic breakout. So much attention is focused on a D-Day type invasion of Taiwan. Well, what happens if they just gradually whittle away our alliances? We take extended deterrence for granted, I think, today. And so I think slick amend can help the region deal with that political coercion.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm not sure Americans have quite come to grips. I mean, the public opinion polling shows that most Americans have a negative view of China, the Chinese Communist Party, the PRC, but I'm not sure they fully understand the potential threat. And so that's one thing, you know, slick amend can help, at least capability-wise, is address that threat. So that's a good wish. I like that wish. Okay, your final wish, what is that one?
Final wish, I would say, you know, I think the debate within the nuclear community is very healthy. It's very strong, very robust, and I hope it just continues in that direction. And I think it most certainly will. But I think the debate thus far has really advanced progress. in with our strategic deterrent. And I think the debate is set. We know what we need to do. And I think we need to move from that debate to implementation and continue thinking long and hard and sustained about this problem, because I think problem was the debate kind of bogged down, I think, in the mid-60s with mutual assured destruction. And I think we need to continue to think long-term about these issues, about hedging. And I think that continuing this debate and talking these issues out is vital for, especially in a democratic society like our own.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, Kyle Balzer, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Well, it was good to talk with Kyle. He's one of the younger voices in the nuclear world that thinks clearly about, you know, nuclear weapons and the role and utility they have. So it was good to hear what he had to say, get his view on SLICM and the early days of tailored deterrence, and then the utility of hedging. So it was a good conversation.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.